think that because we're missing one senator, that we have to have a forum for us to take any action. And Senator Olsen is in a committee right now and having a bill heard. And Senator Last has illness in the family, and so he's not going to be here. And so in that to try and move things along, we would maybe start taking some testimony or have discussion. We won't be able to take any action until Senator Olsen comes, but if we can get some of the information out on the table and for us to begin our discussion. Any objections to that? They were not able to really bring us to order, but we will start to the recording of the committee at this point. And the let's see, why don't we, the first claim that we, I think we have everyone in the room that's here, is the Forest Health Services Cornerstone Villa. Would you like to come up to the table?
Mr. Chair?
Yes. Go ahead.
Could I kind of summarize that briefly, and then we'll hear all the details of it, I'm sure. Many, many details. There's lots of stuff here. We have 300 pages of material almost to read. This is a nursing home in Buell. Construction began on the new building in August of 2003, as I understand it. And the certificate of occupancy was issued in June, at the end of June of 2004, indicating that it was completed. Among other things, that caused the Forest Health Services to pay a early construction bonus to the company that MCR Development that built the building, 52,000 early completion bonus. So during all the time it was being built, they had inspections, the normal inspections by a state building inspector from the Department of Administration, and all the letters are issued by the department. I realize the person was not an employee of the Department of Administration. But I looked at every one of these letters, and they're all letters on the head note on the letterhead of the Department of Administration. Every one of these letters indicating compliance with something in the final certificate of occupancy.
Mr. Manzo.
Well, I think it's important that we clearly identify what agency was responsible for what part of the alleged problem. My understanding is that the enforcement of the building code is kind of a dual responsibility of administration and labor and industry.
Professor, maybe if we wait for the rest of the information to kind of come out before we start getting into details.
Okay.
Otherwise, I'm afraid you might lose me.
Yep.
Mr. Chair, I think that it got shifted from the Department of Administration to the Department of Labor and Industry within the past couple of years. I know because I draft all these building code rules. All of a sudden, I've been dealing for the past year or two with the Department of Labor and Industry. The upshot is that even though we kind of wonder a lot of things about what substantial completion is and whether what the definitions are, whether these companies were insured and bonded that built the building, and how much we should hold the building inspector responsible for ensuring that every nail was nailed. The upshot is that there's a claim here for $101,000 for costs related to having to do a lot of repair work on the building, brand new building, after it was issued its certificate of occupancy. That's basically, as I understand it.
Would you like to introduce yourself for the record? Well, Representative Ruthavina, if you'd like to take the lead on this.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And I'm here, and I, you know, was approached last summer, I think, or mm-hmm. fall, by Ms. Doty from Cornerstone Villa, because, and she was, you know, extremely upset because the building was unsafe, and they had to, at the time, they had had to immediately hire someone to fix what should have been obvious problems that were related to the construction of that building by the state inspector. So with that, I'm just going to have Ms. Doty tell you her horror story, and I think, you know, she should probably get pain and suffering over this, but we're not asking for that. So I'll let her tell the story to the committee.
Well, thank you
for hearing
our claim. Please introduce yourself for the record. This is Deb Doty, and thank you for hearing our claim. Our claim, obviously, is for dollars, you know, and it's on, you know, the dollars are outlined. But the other part of it is the responsibility that a department has to take for the work that they've done or haven't done. This is an extremely upsetting ordeal that we went through. First of all, we're a 44-bed facility, and we provide services to the frail elderly. And what happened with this project is, yes, it was finished in 2004, and the Department of Labor and Industry, Kansas City, who was the inspector, signed off on the CO, Certificate of Occupancy, actually on June 16th. If you look through the inspection report, the official form was 6:30. The Department of Labor and Industry relied on that certificate of occupancy to license our facility. And if you look at the top of your packet, page 1, I did highlight it. This is a letter issued by the Minnesota Department of Health November 29th, 2007, because they were very instrumental in the issue that we had. Because the issue with the structure of our roof was so grave that the Department of Health actually stepped into the process. 2 years and 8 months after this building was occupied, we identified the problem. It only happened by a fluke. You know, I don't know if it was a hand of God on this facility, but we had had severe ice damming problems on our rough snow buildup, and we were trying to remedy that problem. In going through the contractor for that, and in the process of doing that, we hired somebody to come in and do a heat loss study for us. That person came into our building, into our roof, to do a heat loss study. When he came down, he said, "You might want to take a look at your roof structure because things don't quite look right up there." So myself and a maintenance guy went up. I went up in that roof system 3 times. And I came down and reported to a board member that had worked with me on the project. I said, "We obviously have a problem up there." I said, "Either it's really sloppy workmanship or we have a structural weakness." And looking at the clientele that we served, I said, "I have a responsibility to further look into this because I can't operate thinking that there's possibly a problem here." So the board approved hiring a structural engineer. We hired them out of the metro area here. He come in in the afternoon on the 20th of February, and he spent the afternoon. The next morning on the 21st, I met with him first thing in the morning, and he said, "Deb, I can't leave here today and tell you that this building is safe for occupancy." He said, "I can't leave here." So what we did is I went in, he and I, and we called the Minnesota Department of Health, Jim Loveland, and he set over the engineering services, and I reported it because, you know, it was issue to do with our residents and their vulnerability. The structural engineer talked to him, and he said, "Well, I'll get back to you." So he apparently spoke with Mike Triple and Darcy Minor about the issue. They had quite a discussion. Their first thought was evacuate the building immediately. They decided not to do that because such measures also damages our residents. An emergency like that and moving everybody out of a building is going to cause problems for our residents. So they allowed us 24 to 48 hours to correct the most urgent issue in that roof. Trusses literally were not attached to girders. There weren't any hangers. There weren't any nails. They were just sitting there on it. There was literally no bracing in one full wing and one common area. No bracing whatsoever. So you have trusses that are sitting on girders that aren't attached. You have no bracing. Hooking your trusses together, the gable ends of our building were not, they were not attached other than for the sheeting on the roof and the shingles. Had we had straight line winds during that 2 years and 8 months that we, that building was like that, if we would have had straight line winds, that building would have come down like a domino. There was nothing holding it. There's a girder that was actually cut out where they, the trusses didn't fit. They hadn't put it in right. You're talking, it was about 10 feet of the roof, you know, where that truss was sitting. People that walked underneath it could have seen it. And if they would have looked, that was notched out in 10 places. Every 2 feet, that had a notch to fit the truss. It substantially weakened that girder. That wasn't called out. None of this was called out in our state inspections. That was a weakening. And we fixed that. We hired a structural engineer of our own. We paid operating cash to do this. The fees we paid out of operating cash, the early completion bonus, that was based on that certificate of occupancy and the licensing from the Minnesota Department of Health. Would we have paid that if all these structural issues would have had to been taken care of? No, we wouldn't have. The Minnesota Department of Health states in their letter that they would not have let us occupy that building knowing what was wrong with that building. We had to hire, we were required to hire a state inspector to come in. No, they're not there to look and to make sure that we have every nail that we paid for. That I clearly know that that is not the expectation of the Department of Labor and Industry and their inspector, but the very obvious should be pointed out. We, I look on your front page, we had a pattern going here with this inspector. Obvious, we're talking about the roof structure being unsafe, but we also had fire barrier exterior, fire barrier wall damage. The exterior of that building is required to have a 1 hour fire barrier gypsum wall. There were holes in that wall because they were pre-built, they were set by a forklift, and there were actual holes in that fire barrier wall. And that was obvious from the parking lot. And if you had good eyes, you could have seen it from the street. And those, if you look through those inspection reports, that's not called out. How that got remedied was because of owner walkthrough. And we watched that for a period of, when they started closing up that wall with Tyvek and then the interior with the insulation and the gypsum board, both myself and the board member that's with me, Danny Marks, met a number of times with them and demanded that they fix that fire barrier wall before they enclosed it. There were breaches, there were gaps between that we actually called. I called Jim Loveland to ask, can there be a gap between the sheeting on that? And he said, absolutely not. It needs to be tight. It's a fire barrier wall. We brought that back to the contractor. And where was the inspector? These holes in these walls were there for probably 4 months from the time that they set those walls to the time those walls started getting closed in. 4 months. He was on site at least four times during that period of time. Never called it out. Never asked for it to be corrected. If we wouldn't have demanded that, our breach and our firewalls would be there today. Same with our fire barrier in our roof system. There's a fire barrier, I believe it's a smoke containment. Same thing. We have breaches in that where the sheeting isn't tight together. Never called out. We identified that. And wall-mounted lighting, down too low. Design issue. Yes, it was a design issue. Never called out. It did get caught by another agency. But again, the inspector was there. That was part of our building code. Didn't bother to call it out. It got corrected. It got corrected after we opened because another department called this out. The Department of Health has been supporting us all along through this process. They have been absolutely shocked by what has happened with this building. And there is contractor responsibility, and I agree with you. What we're looking for here is, like I said, twofold. You know, we need our operating dollars back. We're a 44-bed nursing home. We have no operating cash. We have no line of credit here. And when we just opened, and we've had to make multiple capital expenditures on this piece. Again, where's the contractor on this? Yes, we do have a contract with NCR Development. He subbed the work out. But you've got to realize that this problem was not identified until 2 years and 8 months after the project was over. We had no way to identify it. Again, we stumbled on it. And if we hadn't stumbled on it, it would never have been corrected until that rust came down. We're currently going into mediation with a contractor regarding this issue and multiple other construction issues. If we don't get satisfaction in mediation, we will be going to binding arbitration. Again, for our attorney, takes a long time. If we litigate, we're going to burn up probably more money than what our claim is, according to them. But we are going into binding arbitration if we do get satisfaction on any of these dollars that we requested. We will subrogate those to the state of Minnesota. We're not looking for the state of Minnesota to pay for this totally, you know, if there's responsibility on the contractor. But again, we're looking at 2 years and 8 months after this happened. The other piece of this, again, is taking responsibility. You know, as a public facility, as an administrator, I take responsibility for what I do and what my employees do. You know, if my employees do something that they shouldn't do or there's this vast oversight, I get called in the carpet by the Minnesota Department of Health. The Minnesota Department of Health, their inspectors are overseen by the feds. The federal surveyors come in and look at them. Who looks at the Department of Labor and Industry? Who looks at these inspectors? And in here, their claim is that that they don't have any moral obligation. Well, in their response, they said, we don't feel we have any moral responsibility here. They signed off on that certificate of occupancy, that all these inspections were complete and everything was okay. When there wasn't the little nails that were missing, we had glaring problems with this building. When they signed off on that, the Minnesota Department of Health relied on that certificate of occupancy to issue a license for this building. We relied on the state inspector to say that this building was substantially up to code. You know, could there be small code violations? Yes, there could be. There should never be something so glaring that you put 44 residents and staff and the public at risk of potential injury and or death. Because if that roof would have come down, we would have had a major problem. And they signed off on it. They have no moral responsibility here. I disagree. They're an employee of the state, just like I'm an employee of Cornerstone Villa. And if I do something that's negligent, I'm going to be held accountable. And I think that a statement needs to come out. The state of Minnesota, they hung their platter out. They hung a plaque out saying, we are going to tell you, you have to purchase our services. But you can't rely on them. We couldn't rely on their inspections to call out issues such as this. But we have no moral responsibility here. You know, again, it's extremely upsetting that we went through this process and we had people such as that, you know, in grave danger during this process.
I just want to apologize for using the term missing a few nails, because it's obvious that girders, I mean, having these trusses not secured to the girders, I mean, this is just a massive incompetence in building this building, and it's not a matter of missing a few nails. I apologize for using that term.
And what I'd like to do today is for us to pull in as much information as we can so we can kind of determine as to what our appropriate role will be in your issue and concern.
You know,
Mr. Chair,
if I could emphasize the fact that they this is a small community and a 44-bed nursing home. And in fact, Representative Ruth's uncle, Stevie Antimovich, is in there, a good friend of mine. And this, you know, they had to use basically any reserve they had to immediately hire that same day, the morning that she met with the structural engineer. They had construction workers on the spot tying down those trusses to the building because nothing was attached. And, you know, we had this, those straight line winds up there. We can have them. We could have had a huge catastrophe here. And it would be one thing if it was something that wasn't obvious, but I think it was. And I think there's an obligation here by the fact that they had to hire a state inspector, that they wouldn't have been licensed by Minnesota Department of Health if they hadn't. And obviously somebody screwed up and somebody should be held responsible for that.
And Representative Rukavina, I understand that concern. The problem is we're not a court of law. And some of us on this panel are not in any way trained in the court of law. We have some lawyers sitting here, but it's not, I'm not one of them. And so I think we want to bring out all the information so we can gather as much information as possible. I want to reserve and let you know we need to talk about what would be the proper goal for us to play and at what time and so forth. And, but first we need to get all the information, of course. So that's what I'd like to do right now.
Okay. Senator Hinch. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Dylan, for being here. And I have a question, I guess, and I think Representative Osmond is correct. We are not a court of law, and our task is to understand the circumstances and determine to what extent the claim should be validated by the state. But in the course of this building, who was the project manager overseeing the construction?
MCI Development was the construction manager.
In the story, I'm sorry, I don't want to be confusing here, but typically you hire a contractor and they have somebody that manages the project from their side. But I'm talking about from the institution side. Who is responsible in your organization to make sure that job got done?
In our organization?
During the construction. As a building was built, typically when you build a building, you've got somebody who represents the organization putting the building up, and they have responsibility to make sure that building is done and oversees the contractor and relationship and so forth. And who is that person in your organization?
That would have been MCR Development. We didn't have, you know, MCR Development is who we contracted with. He's a developer slash construction manager.
Chairman, I understand that you hired them to do the construction, but they don't represent your interests in the building. They represent their interests in the building. And my question is, who is representing your interests in the building?
We had architectural resources as an architect, yes. That would have been the only person. Otherwise, we had a contract with MCR Development, and then we also had a contract with architectural resources on the project.
Mr. Chairman,
I
guess what I'm getting at is you list some things in here that, and I'm not an engineer, but if I would have seen those things, I would not have said this is appropriate, and I would have said we got to get a new contractor. They're not doing the job. All I'm trying to find out is who in your organization was overseeing that relationship so that these things to me don't even need to have an inspector to look at them. They're so obvious as they're listed here that someone as untrained as I would say, that's not right. And so somebody from your side, as the building was going up, was responsible to make sure that construction should have. I mean, was there nobody that was involved in that process?
The Buell Nursing Home, before it was Cornerstone Villa, was a little nursing home in the town in the old Buchanan Hospital. And the hospital was old, and I guess Ms. Doty probably could have been the building inspector, because in a nursing home in rural Minnesota, you're barely getting enough reimbursement right now to pay your staff, much less, and take care of the patients. I know. I go to a nursing home 5 times a week. My mother's in one. My aunt was in the same nursing home for the previous 4 years. She was trying to move her patients out of a building that was not in good shape by the Department of Health and build this building at the same time. She thought she hired the experts from the state to make sure that the building was constructed properly. She was trying to run a hospital or run a nursing home, take care of patients, get them moved into a brand new building, and in the process, thought that the architect was watching for their concerns, but also that this state inspector, who they were told they had to hire in order to get licensed, would have caused what was obviously a bunch of obvious mistakes. So I think Ms. Doty, I guess, in answering your question to her, she thought that the building inspector from the state was her looking out for her interest, because they don't have the wherewithal and the money. The cash flow on these nursing homes, it's terrible what's going on out there.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Hanf, Representative Rukavina, and I appreciate that, but I know nobody who relies on a state inspector to be a contract overseer in the construction of a building. That's just not done anywhere that I'm aware of. Because if you're putting up a building, you as the owner have a responsibility.
If I could at this point, I'd really rather us get the information that you have, because I think there's some, regardless of who eventually is to blame and who's going to actually pay and that sort of thing, I suspect we're going to have to wait for the courts for your actions that you've already instigated to kind of play out. But I heard you say that the big message that you wanted us to hear is what the state's action has been or not been, and so that we as legislature would be aware of that as well as the concern about the dollars and cents. Because I think you started out by saying this is not about money as much as it is about the responsibility or the concerns that you had with the actions of some state agents. So I'd like to get all the information on table first before we get into too much detail or discussion. Representative Anto.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think you came very, very close to the crux of the situation here. The public interest is what's at stake. And the state of Minnesota is charged with the responsibility of protecting the public. And it's clear that in this case, this facility and these residents, who, by the way, whose care is also most oftentimes, at least partially, provided by the public, that the public interest wasn't served. We licensed the facility. The health department is not a construction agency. The health department is a public health agency. Whether it's the Department of Labor and Industry or administration, these are the people who have the expertise about construction. I know a little bit about construction. I worked 15 years for the building trade. And I can't imagine any situation where the owners of an office tower in downtown Minneapolis would be expected on their own to certify that the construction was done in a manner that they saw fit. They aren't the experts. The public provides that service. And in this case, and in that case, the public entity, whether it's DOL or administration, didn't perform the function to anyone's satisfaction. Somebody's culpable here.
You represent that. I think that that's one of the reasons why I'd like to really use this as a time to get the information out on the table. Because those of us that are in the metropolitan area have different experiences. For example, I was a fire marshal for Minneapolis, and in that experience, the buildings that would go up, we would be going to the architects and the engineers to depend upon the integrity of that building, and then we're verifying those types of things. So it's, and the roles, I think, are different in rural Minnesota. And so rather than trying to get into all that, trying to sort this out, we could get some of the information out, because there does seem to be, if they've received a certificate of occupancy and this building has this type of faults that are constructed into it, that in itself, regardless of how we sort out who's going to pay what, that in itself is an extreme interest to the state of Minnesota and to myself as a legislator. And so I'd like to get more of that information. here before us at this point. And then I think that some of the dollars and cents questions may have to be deferred to a later time. But if we could, if that'd be okay if we pursue that?
And Mr. Chairman, just a question. Do we have anybody from the agency that did the inspections here?
We have agency people here, yes. Okay, is there additional information that you'd like us to know at this point? So,
well, Mr. Chair, if I could just add, and Senator Ann and Representative Anderson, they paid some pretty hefty fees to the state of Minnesota. And, you know, regardless of the outcome of your decision, one would question why the fees were paid in the first place when the job obviously wasn't done. And, you know, I think there is a question of responsibility here, whether it's, you know, financial or moral or whatever, I guess is up to this committee. I'm hoping you'll consider the whole situation here and the fact that these little rural nursing homes don't have very much money to operate with, and what little cash flow that Ms. Doty had here had to be spent correcting up problems on a brand new building. But the final analysis is that somebody didn't do their job, but there's the bill right there. They got paid for it, but they didn't do their job. So.
Any other information at this point? Well, you'll have a chance to come back if we need to. Representative Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to Ms. Doty, just so I really understand the fact situation, your early completion bonus, which is a significant amount of money, mm-hmm. And I know that, at least I've heard, I'm not a construction person, I'm not a lawyer, I've learned a lot in claims committee, but I understand that's a pretty typical part of negotiating a construction contract. Is that written simply by, you know, you have it done by this date so we can start moving people in? Does it have other terms and conditions upon that, you know, earning that in terms of quality or anything else? Can you tell me what was sort of in the terms of the deal on the $53,000?
The early completion bonus was based on, actually the contract was through July 31st of 2004, and for every day that the contractor was done prior to that, so many dollars were to be paid from Forest Health Services to that contractor. And the contract was basically what they consider to be substantial completion, and the contract is in your packet. Substantial completion was the signing off of the building's code inspector on the certificate of occupancy, which did maybe unofficially happen on 6/16. It's right in his inspection that was there. And then after that, of course, in the state of Minnesota, Department of Health licensed the facility for occupancy, which they did on June 22nd of 2004, which basically stated we could occupy the building. That's how the early completion bonus date was set on 6/22, because both the certificate of occupancy and the licensing was done on that building, and the licensing for the letter that I have here was dependent on a number of things, one of which was a certificate of occupancy by the building code inspector. So then as of 6/22 of 2004, then that's when we started counting back the number of days we had to pay that early completion bonus. I just wanted to follow up, and I admit I did not read the contract in that detail, but it was only about days done early, not statements of quality in that particular document. Is that correct? Look it up. Well, yes and no. I mean, the Department of Health, when they come in and do their final inspection, they speak to the quality of the building. The Department of Health comes into the building, actually does an inspection on that building, and they go through the building more from looking at the interior portion of that building. They don't look at the construction piece because they depend on other state inspectors for the actual hidden stuff, like the structural stuff, electrical, that type of thing. And they come in, they look at the quality, but, you know, it was all designed. It was supposedly built for design, which, you know, so I'm not quite sure what your question is other than...
Chairman?
Representative Lawson.
Chair and Commissioner, but I was just trying to understand a little bit more about the strength of the legal claim that you have going into the next step of mediation. You know, if there's an issue of quality in that agreement, then that might perhaps increase your ability to, through the arbitration and mediation process, you know, have that claim upheld through that process.
Mr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Folks, the health department licenses the beds and certifies the facility as a long-term care public health facility eligible for one thing or another, medical assistance reimbursement and so on. It isn't the health department's job to look at trusses and roofs and shingles and gables. But the health department also has a responsibility to see to it that the building, the physical structure, meets the state building code, or they wouldn't have issued their license to the facility in the first place. So some miscommunication obviously happened there between the health department and whomever is responsible for the inspection of the building, whether it's commerce, administration, labor and industry, or whoever. I think we need to get at that issue as well as the quality of the inspection.
We're trying.
Okay.
Mr. Lendeke.
Mr. Chair, just one more question. This is such an odd number, $13,671.88, fees paid to the state of Minnesota. Are those all fees paid to Mr. C, the building inspector, or what are all of these fees for, and why is it such an odd number?
My understanding is there's a calculation that the state uses. These are dollars that actually went to the state of Minnesota that were for the building's permit and plan review. How they came up with those dollars, and those are actually the dollars that came right off the checks that we submitted to the state, but there's some type of a formulary that they use in determining what those fees are.
But Mr. Chair, some of these, like plan review, and apparently the plans were good. When the construction was shoddy. So some of these, like plan review, you might have gotten your money's worth.
And I would agree that we did. But my understanding, plan review went fine. These are all bundled together. I believe they're broken out on the big packet that you have. So those are just the dollars that we paid to the state of Minnesota for that whole service.
And if we get the, we have the department response to Senator Hinn.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Doty, just one, I guess, maybe final clarification. We've talked about two parts of the claim. The third part, actual expenses incurred, paid from operations. What is that amount for? What are you paying there, and to whom, and for what reason?
So, Mr. Chair, I think Senator, when they were told by that structural engineer, when he discovered what was really going on up there, he said to Ms. Doty, I'm not leaving here today until you... I can't leave here. These residents are in jeopardy. So I think those expenses are the actual expenses to tie down the trusses and brace them, because it would have been like a thumb, you know, nothing was tied in. The whole, you know, all the trusses could have just easily went like this. And so that is the actual expense, from what I understand, that they incurred to, after the fact, get carpenters into that building and do the work over a 48-hour whatever period, and probably a little longer.
Chairman. Thank you, Ms. Senator Rookavina and Ms. Doty. So after the shoddy construction was discovered, you paid about $35,000 to get that, all that stuff repaired, so now it's, everything is okay. What was the total cost of the building? Was it a million-dollar project? What was the total cost?
$4.6 million.
Mr. Chairman, so out of the $4.6 million, you had a $35,000 problem that is represented by the list here that you then, after the fact, paid to
some other contractor, the same contractor to repair.
No,
I didn't think it was, but I just wanted to say.
No, this, we brought in people to fix the roof. Obviously, we had one construction person on site. When we did correct the problem, we actually corrected the problem within 8 hours of being notified by the structural engineer. That's how concerned we were with the project. We didn't take the 24 to 48 hours. We actually did the nailing into the evening with lights on people's heads because we were so concerned about the safety of that building. The rest of it took a period of time since we had to hire a structural engineer. The Department of Labor and Industry, I can tell you, did step up to the plate in sending an inspector in to identify the problems that weren't identified originally. And worked very well with us during that process. But we did have to hire a structural engineer during that process because we had a girder and it was outside the girder that was caught. And then some other issues that were there, obviously the building code inspector couldn't tell us how to fix anything. And the actual engineer had to design a fix for some of it because it was structurally weakened. It wasn't just a matter of putting a 2x4 up. So this includes labor, material, further structural engineer services. But I also want to add in there that the $34,000, $35,000 could have been a lot more. We brought in volunteers on this that actually went up and pounded nails with guidance on what to do. So we brought in volunteers to do that. We didn't purchase equipment. It was volunteer equipment. So that dollar, you know, we... we're very responsible in spending those dollars. We tried to do it as economically, yet as completely as we possibly could because, one, we couldn't afford to spend a whole lot of dollars on this. So there, this dollar here, if it looks like a lot, I'm not sure if it looks like a lot or a little here, but that dollar amount could have been substantially higher had we paid for every service that went into that roof. But we had volunteers that actually came in and help with that project.
Mr. Chairman, one last question. Does the organization that erected the building, what kind of insurance do they have, or did they have in the course of to assure that the project would be done? Any
indication with them?
Bonds that were posted by the contractors to cover things of this nature, and just how is that, what's the status of that, or can you just tell us what the...
There was insurance, looking through the contract, there was insurance. Actually, the insurance was the liability insurance ceased shortly after the building was erected and it was final done on it. The bonding is, actually the bonding is between the subcontractor and the contractor, not with us, because we had subs on that project. And again, the question is 2 years, 8 months after the fact, is the bonding going to hold up? The attorney's looking into it, but doubts that we're going to have a lot of success there because it wasn't identified within that first year period of time. And again, that's where we're into mediation and arbitration right now because we'll force that card, but our attorney is telling us, you know, that isn't something that after this period of time that we should be sure that will happen. Highly doubts that. Again, we can litigate. We can take the contractor and the subs to court. What we have been told, and again, isn't your issue, but what we've been told, to take a construction claim like this to court, it's going to cost us probably as much as our claim is. So then where do we get the dollars to litigate? We don't have any money. You know, we didn't have money to fix it in the first place. And so all of a sudden we're going to get into a construction battle over this and start paying attorney fees. And we might get our dollars back, but we're going to spend a lot of dollars trying to get those dollars back. We don't have the money to do it. And again, should we have to do that when there were people that had oversight here? We shouldn't be in this. We shouldn't be in this predicament to begin with for any number of reasons, but what we've been told by our attorney is stay away from litigation as much as you possibly can because it's a lose-lose situation for everybody. You know, and again, then You know, so we spent all this money. Do we come back to the state and say, well, now we spent all this money on legal fees, you guys, because of this issue, will you cover our legal fees here? I mean, again, it could turn into this snowball thing that we don't want it to turn into. We want our operating cash back, and we want somebody to be held responsible for what didn't happen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Forest Health Service, what is that?
It's a nonprofit corporation.
Are you a proprietary chain of long-term care facilities?
No, we're freestanding. We stand alone. We don't have a big brother. We're not owned by a city. We're not owned by a county. We're not owned by a larger corporation. We're one of the few nursing homes left in the state of Minnesota that's totally independent and totally freestanding. We have nobody to go to help us here to say, hey, would you pay our legal fees? Can you pay for these fees? Because we don't have them in operations. We can't borrow from Peter to pay Paul. We're freestanding. We're one of the few nursing homes left in the state of Minnesota.
You're a small little nursing home, and you're former competitor on the basketball court, Mr. Marks, is on the board, I believe, still.
Yeah.
And it's a local board of people.
Yep.
Okay. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, member.
Could we have the department come up? Both the committee, if you identify yourself to the record, heard the claim. Respond, please.
Chairman Osment, I'm Nancy Lepink. I'm General Counsel for the Department of Labor and Industry. And with me today is Scott McCullen, who is an Assistant Director of Plan Review and Regional Services with the Department of Labor and Industry.
And Nancy, your last name again?
Leppink.
PP?
PPINK.
Thank you.
I just have one initial question for the committee. It seems that you received some additional information. The state did not. So we have not had the opportunity to review what was in your envelope.
Mr. Chair, I'll make sure that we make a copy or give a copy to them of the materials that we received. She has some excellence.
And I guess I would have some concern in the sense that my understanding of the committee is...
If you just respond to the claim and the comments that have been made here, it would be just great.
I guess what I'll do initially, since probably you're more interested in the specifics of what occurred here, turn this over to Mr. McCullen to go through with you what the role, what is the, how the department works with respect to projects like this, what is the services that it provides, how those services are provided, and then specifically what happened in this case, would seem, I think, to be of most interest to the committee in light of Cornerstone Bill's testimony.
Especially as to the actions or inactions of the inspector and how that...
Okay.
We're not trying to get into lots of detail today. We just need to get a good understanding as to what the concerns are so we can decide as to how to handle this. Not necessarily how to decide.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. My name is Scott McClellan. I'm an Assistant Director of the Construction Codes and Licensing Division of the Department of Labor and Industry. And specifically, I manage the Plan Review and Regional Services Unit. And I'd like to take maybe just 5 or 7 minutes just to go over maybe 4 points that relate to this. First, our statutory responsibility for these kinds of buildings, our regulatory role in general, and then thirdly, our role in the Cornerstone Villa project, and lastly, our involvement with the roof truss issue. So briefly, first of all, our statutory authority. One of our roles in construction codes and licensing is the administration of the state building code on public buildings and state licensed facilities, such as Cornerstone Villas, nursing home, hospitals, correctional facilities, DOT, DNR buildings, that type of thing. And we either delegate that work to local government to handle that process, or we do it ourselves, which is the case in Cornerstone Villas. Second, our regulatory role. Our Plan Review and Regional Services Unit is responsible to review and approve building plans for new buildings, additions, or remodelings to these types of facilities. We then issue permits and we make inspections. We basically operate just like a local building inspection department does, except our territory is the entire state of Minnesota. We review plans and perform inspections for structural code compliance, such as the issue we're discussing, general life safety, fire safety, accessibility, energy, mechanical systems, those types of things. And we have the state divided into six regions with six building inspectors that office within each of those. And these regions may have 20 to 30 projects going at any one time during the year. And although that may not seem like a lot to a city or municipality, our regions are quite large. They cover 10 to 15 counties, 20,000 square miles with one inspector. So there's a vast territory to cover. Our building inspectors and all building inspectors in the state are responsible by law for inspecting buildings at certain key stages of construction. A minimum of 7 specific inspections are required to be made at certain intervals of construction to verify compliance with certain features such as the footings, the foundation, the framing, the final, and a few others. In addition, the inspector will likely make additional inspections to examine other areas of the construction process, and the number of those depends on the complexity of the building and the time available by the inspector. Now, a common belief is that this municipal building inspection process results in a certification that all code compliance can be warranted, and that's simply not the case. Periodically inspecting a construction site for code compliance can't result in that type of a certification. However, if all of the required inspections have been performed by qualified individuals, there is a high likelihood that the important facets of the code would have been satisfied during construction. And this is really all that the law expects of that municipal inspection process. The municipal building inspections are only snapshots of what they see at the time they're at the job site. And after they leave, work gets covered up and things could change. Now, this municipal inspection process is in contrast to that of what we would call a quality control program that might be facilitated by an owner's rep, such as a construction manager, which is often retained to provide that type of service. A quality control program does require someone to be on site all the time to be certain that all work is completed in accordance with the contract documents. In effect, in this instance, the owners of the Cornerstone Villa project did employ a construction manager, a general contractor, and subs that, in effect, provided a pretty high level of owner representation. Our role in the Cornerstone Villa project number 3. Application for this nursing home was submitted to our office for plan approval in June of 2003. We reviewed the plan, and on August 1st, we sent a letter to the architect identifying a number of code deficiencies that we found. The architect then responded to some of them in writing, not all of them, and that process repeated itself 2 more times until we had the plans correct and ready to issue the building permit. And that permit was then issued on October 14th. Because our inspector's office was 2.5 hours away from the iron range, this inspector made what we'd call periodic or progress inspections. This means that until he was requested to be out there at a specific time or date, he would make weekly or semi-weekly inspections trips to all of his projects. And when the contractor needed him to make a specific required inspection, then it was the contractor's duty to let him know that he had the footings ready to pour, the framing ready for the final inspected, or the final inspection performed. On this particular project, we do have record that our inspector made at least 18 inspections that he recorded, not including the plumbing and electrical that were handled by others, 3 of which dealt specifically with the roof system, where he made some sort of comment regarding the status of the roof system under construction. However, we did not find any evidence in our file of a final framing inspection report that should have been performed and approved by the inspector after all the trusses and all the framing were completed. Moving up lastly then to our most recent involvement with the roof trusses. As has already been told, Cornerstone Villa had suffered some ice damming backups and water leaking. They hired numerous consultants to try to address the issue. In the course of that process, they hired a structural engineer to take a closer look at things. When the structural engineer got in the roof, he noticed there were a lot of connections that were missing, bracing that wasn't there, and some real technical and specific things. And he contacted the administrator, who then got a hold of Jim Loveland from the state's health department to relay their concerns. So it was just about a year ago, February 22nd, that I received a phone call from Jim Loveland, who told me that a structural hazard had been discovered in the roof of this nursing home up in Buell, and that if it wasn't addressed soon, he would order the nursing home residents evacuated. Sounded pretty serious, so I immediately contacted our new inspector on the site and had him stop over to see what services he could provide. He took a look at things with the director of the facility up there, the campus. After his inspection, then he reported to the administrator what he had found, and certainly there were some of the hangers were missing. They weren't all missing, and there was a lot of bracing that had not been installed. And before he left the site, some of those hangers were being installed by the staff of the nursing home. But because our inspector noticed that there were a number of items that needed to be addressed, and he didn't have time to do that kind of extensive inspection at the time, 3 weeks later we dispatched two additional inspectors that worked full-time for 2 days crawling around in the attic up there, along with the original truss plan, to do a thorough evaluation of the roof structure. Again, this is an enormous roof. It's 40,000 square feet, containing over 500 roof trusses every 2 feet. So there is a lot of lumber up there that needed to be looked at.
Excuse me just a moment. We will call the meeting to order. We do have a quorum.
Continue, please. Afterward, we compiled a detailed report of the information necessary for the owner to effect corrections to the roof. We did not generate a formal correction notice to the contractor because it appeared to us the owner and the contractor had already indicated a readiness and willingness to take care of the any needed corrections. And although it didn't matter to us who made the corrections, it was our expectation that the original contractor would likely probably make them. He was involved in some of the meetings we were at originally. In the end, the administrator did seem pleased with our response and the completeness and timeliness of the report. In conclusion, I've got 4 points. First of all, despite the fact that the roof had been safely transferring snow and wind loads for 3 years, it had successfully weathered snowfalls from 3 winters without incident, there was likely little safety factor left in the event, someone mentioned earlier, that there was a high wind or snowfall. In no way do I want to minimize the condition of the roof structure. It did perform for those 3 years under normal situations with snow and wind, but had there been something extreme out of the ordinary, it may not have performed as well. We would not have characterized the initial inspection as urgent, that if people had to be evacuated. Again, it had stood for 3 years, and unless they were in the midst of a heavy snow or a high wind, I don't think anyone was under any specific risk. But it's always better to be safe than sorry. Second of all, when we discovered the deficiencies in the roof construction, we immediately deployed staff to the building until a thorough and complete report could be prepared to present for corrections. And even though these roof corrections were discovered after the fact of occupancy, it remains the responsibility of the owner and or permit holder to correct the violations. And although we don't have any record of our inspector approving a final framing inspection, the fact remains that the connection of the trusses and the truss bracing were not completed by the on-site contractors. Perhaps a final comment that might help clarify a little bit. The State Health Department does contract with the State Fire Marshal's Office to provide inspections of nursing homes and hospitals for life safety items that are found in the life safety code. There's a little bit of overlap between our codes in Minnesota and the federal codes that they use. They're not looking at structural matters, however, they're looking at life safety, firewalls, those types of things. So.
Have you taken any action against the person that was inspector up there for having or allowing an occupancy certificate to be given to a building that has obvious deficiencies?
Mr. Chair, that employee had soon after left state service and retired. I could perhaps add a little bit of clarification. This employee was formerly in a different role with department administration. He was one of two inspectors, staff people that were originally hired to evaluate contract inspectors. We only had staff for two to cover our responsibility to inspect state projects, so we normally would write work orders with existing contractors in the state, inspection contractors. And these folks were monitors. And then the role changed where we actually were going to provide the service ourselves. And this person was relocated to northeastern Minnesota or close to it. So he admittedly had difficulty in that transition to being an inspector. He knew the what needed to be done. He didn't have a lot of time or tools to get the job done. But he's all we had in the area.
Okay, how about the actions? Does the department license the contractor? Who licenses the contractor?
Mr. Chair, there is no statewide licensing of commercial contractors, just residential.
That's interesting. No idea if that was the case. Okay, no licenses. So have you talked to the Attorney General with regard to negligence on this and any charges that should be brought against the employee?
No, Mr. Chair.
Do you think that should take place?
To be honest, Mr. Chair, I don't know that that would be warranted. I don't have firsthand evidence that he willingly looked the other way. He actually did observe the truss erection and construction. I don't know what he verbally passed on to the contractor in terms of telling them, make sure you get all the hangers in. Normally what happens is they go and they tack all the trusses in place. They come back later and then put all the hangers in. What's one of the last steps in the process. We should have been there at that stage. We weren't. But I could see that the inspector could have been acting in good faith, relaying proper information, just never got the request to go back for a final.
Yeah, perfect on that. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In your best recollection, was there ever a time in the process of remediating the deficiencies where the nursing home administrator, the responsible contractor, and the inspector were all together trying to work out a corrective action?
Representative Ansel, we recognize that our authority was limited, but we did determine that we would provide all the assistance we possibly could. And again, that involved a two-day full-time inspection, chasing down truss reports, truss layouts. We met with the representative of the nursing home, all of their contractors to try to lay out what we saw, what we believe the next steps for correction should be. We did take it as far as we thought we could.
Can I ask, in that follow-up inspection that you had the two inspectors up there for 2 days, the deficiencies that they identified, were they consistent with the testimony that was presented to
Mr. Chair, yes, indeed.
Mm-hmm. Senator Hamm.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. McClellan, you stated in your testimony that, I think you said you have no record of a final framing inspection or final framing report. I'm going to assume that one wasn't done, that may have been done and may have gotten misplaced or something, but I'm assuming for purposes of this discussion it didn't get done. And my question is that, had that inspection been done, as it typically or normally would have been done, would the kinds of deficiencies that are noted here, would they have been noted and would they have been addressed if that had been done?
McClellan.
Senator Hahn, that's a good question. if the proper final inspection was requested, there would have been no drywall on the ceiling, no vapor barrier hanging down, so everything would have been visible. It would have been a very lengthy inspection. Likely, we would have been able to catch many of those items. Likely, we wouldn't have caught everything. I actually asked that question to some of my staff. We have currently outstanding, very detail-oriented inspectors, if that provides you with any comfort, which is unfortunate in this instance. And I asked them, how much detail would you have spent in time in these kinds of trusses? And three of our six that I spoke to are the type of people that would have got a jack and went up there, a lift, and looked at as much as they possibly could. Now, again, I don't even believe they'd have time to evaluate everything. They have a lot on their plate. Our role is not that of a full-time construction inspector, but it's to identify the obvious that then you can relay to the contractor a representative sampling of what you've seen and say, look, the bracing isn't all complete. It needs to get completed, if that answers your question.
Senator Hand. Thank you, and thank you, Mr. McClellan. I guess one other question that I think you addressed in your opening comments, but the claim seems to be based on the theory that the inspection process is a certification that the specifications of the construction plan have been fully met, and that it is the duty of the state to ensure that that gets done, and that if things are discovered that are not in compliance with the original plans or the intent, then it is the state's responsibility to cover those costs that are related to that. And could you just clarify what your position is with respect to that theory of claim and how HIPAA, I mean, other experiences that the department may have had with other buildings, other inspections, I'm sure there's been other disputes about claims, and maybe not to this degree, but could you just give us a little bit of insight into how this fits with the other experiences the department's had with this type of theory of claim?
Senator Hahn, it's not unusual, because this is not a certification process, that in some instances there's a discovery later of a violation that existed. The codes recognize that when they describe the responsibility of the inspector, when they describe what the certificate of occupancy, when those requirements say that this should not imply that a violation shall be deemed as valid if it's discovered after the fact. That's a pure paraphrase. So it does happen on occasion. And frankly, as code officials, we strongly dislike when that happens, because that means we feel that we failed in our process. Even though we realize it's not exhaustive by any means, we'd like to think that we've caught everything that we should have, the obvious discoveries. What normally happens, if we become aware of something, we have no option but to call it out and to require it to be corrected, whether that be at a local government level or whether that be at the state level. It happens extremely rarely at our level. I'm not saying that some violations don't exist out there in construction. I'm sure they do. We all know that. But this is probably the first time in the 20 years that I've been with this unit that has come forth as an issue. When it does, under Minnesota law, municipalities, building inspectors, including the state of Minnesota, as a code official, I should say, acting as a state building inspector, as long as there's no malice proven in the course of their duties, that generally they're not held liable for omissions that they haven't discovered.
Mr. Chairman. Senator Hand, I think, final question here, but was there any sense on the part of your inspector or the department that the contractors were engaging in some kind of, fraud may be too strong a word, but deception? In other words, I understand how buildings get inspected. I know they're not there every day. You come in at certain times and inspect certain things. If a contractor is interested in trying to disguise certain things, they certainly, at least in theory, have the ability to do that. My question is, in the case of this roof issue, was there any feeling, either at the time or after the fact, that the contractors were trying to deceive the inspectors and inspection process in some way to get the building completed on time, collect the bonus, be done? Any indication of that?
McClellan.
Senator Hahn, I have no knowledge of that in particular. The only thing that we did become aware of, if anyone was tracking the chronology, we approved the building permit the building permit was issued October 14th, and the construction started around August 1st, which I was not aware of as a supervisor at the time. Beyond that, I'm not aware of any other intentional fraud.
Representative Laughlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And to Mr. McClellan, it seems to me that we have sort of a lack of consistency within your agency. I mean, part of the claims committee is we discover issues of faith, shortcomings on our part, maybe the lack of licensing for commercial contractors. But we also get to see sort of how our agencies work. And if I just want to make sure that I understood that you took two people who really hadn't done on-site monitoring and moved them into a different role for which you indicated that one may not have even had the appropriate tools. And you told us they quickly retired soon after this. Is the other one still on staff? And did you think, the second question would be, you said that three of six, when you inquired, said they would have gone up on the roof. That says that even within your experienced long-term site inspectors, there's no uniform expectation on degree of performance. Is that correct?
McCall.
Representative Loeffler. When I mentioned three of six, those are the only three I contacted. I don't know that my others wouldn't have as well. In fact, as their supervisor, former supervisor, I used to have to rein them in and remind them that they are not the project inspectors. They often spend too much time and too much detail for the right reason, and they are very good at what they do. But sometimes they get caught up in their responsibility. They are very conscientious. Your first question relating to moving those two folks into roles, the folks that we did, they were previous experienced inspectors. They did apply for these positions because they were new. And at the same time, we opened up five regions, so we did have others apply for the other regions. They probably weren't the most skilled folks that we had at the time, but they did qualify, and they had been employees in that field. The other individual retired long before this one did, as a matter of fact. That answers your question.
And
thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative
Lawson? Well, I can. This is on a different issue, so I can wait.
Representative Angel?
Mr. McClellan, most certainly this isn't the first skilled nursing home facility that the state building code and the health department have inspected and licensed. One could conclude that the health departments wouldn't issue an occupancy license without knowing that the building was constructed in accordance with the state building code, and that any hazards to residents were taken care of. It just seems to me this all could have been so easily prevented had there been some communication between the two agencies. Are there procedures in place for that communication to take place? And did that communication not take place in this case?
Representative Anzal, you are correct. Our roles do overlap, and we have expressed concerns with our agency heads and others that our roles need to be better coordinated, if not under the same umbrella, so that when we do meet with the architect and review plans, for example, they're not getting a separate review as they are today. And when we make inspections, we're coordinating with the state fire marshal to make sure we're looking at the same thing. We have enough coordination where Jim Loveland, Mr. Loveland, knew to call me that we had something to do with this project. So we are connected, but oftentimes things do get we do get into a lot of discrepancies over jurisdiction, which is something you don't want to hear today. But that usually is the problem, not this type of problem.
Mr. Lindeke.
Mr. Chair, Mr. McClellan, when we're talking briefly about what these fees paid to the state of Minnesota were, some of them apparently were for plan review, and apparently that was done adequately and the plans were fine. Some of it must have been money paid to the department for Mr. C's services. Although I did say that they probably got their money's worth on the plan review, do you think they got their money's worth on the fees paid to Mr. C?
Mr. Lindeke, Mr. C was an employee of the state of Minnesota, so he was not under a contractual arrangement. He was just paid a salary out of our budget. We did obviously put a lot of work into the plan review side of things, where we normally think most of the code review work should be done. It took several months to get the architect to get everything correct before we would issue the permit. I believe they got their money's worth on that side of things. I wouldn't pretend to say they got their money's worth on the inspection side. We did provide a lot of service, a lot of travel time, a lot of on-site inspections, but we obviously didn't contribute to preventing this problem.
And one other question, Ms. Representative Osment was suggesting that you in some way go after Mr. C to charge him with some kind of negligence here, and you indicated that there's no sign that he intentionally made any of these mistakes that apparently were made. But you also said that we couldn't find any evidence that there was a sign-off on the final framing or the roof trusses and any of that kind of work. Did you not talk with Mr. C after this? Isn't there some detailed discussion within the department with Mr. C once these problems became clear?
Lindeke, he had long since retired, so I haven't.
So you didn't talk with him at all because he had retired?
Correct.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Olson?
Has the nursing home taken legal action against the contractor and the architect in this?
The testimony was that to the committee that they have some negotiations going on and binding arbitration, was it?
Mediation.
So there is some, they've taken some, but not. No legal action because of the cost of the lawsuits. They felt that their advice is to lose more in lawyer fees than they would gain and be able to recover.
Interesting. I've worked in the construction industry as a supplier for a good part of my life when I was younger, and it seems to me that, you know, not nailing trusses down and not securing them properly, I mean, that's fundamentally a flaw in the construction, whoever was doing the roofing and setting those trusses, and I'm trying to envision an inspector. And I heard you mention using a lift going up to make sure I don't believe an inspector would be looking to make sure every nail is nailed in. I mean, that's kind of the standard procedure of building a building, is nailing it together on a wood frame. It's very interesting to me that. You know, I was reading in some of these notes, and it sounded like one day it was a snowy day, and, you know, they were still working, and, you know, I don't know if they were just trying to get done so fast they were shortcutting everything, but it really seems to me that this is more a case of negligence on the contractor's part.
And Mr. Olsen, as I've been listening, we've been trying to gather facts and decide as to what to do, and I think maybe I'll just throw something out for people to consider as you continue to ask your questions. But to me, it does seem that there is some potential gross negligence on the part of the contractor, some negligence with regard to the inspector. I don't know what the state's interest really is. If we end up with addressing a claim, it seems to me that the state may be interested in actually going after the contractor. I would like to suggest that we would hold this over and have the Attorney General take a look at this and give us some advice as to what we should or should not be doing. I don't want to make a bad situation worse. When there actually may need to have some criminal actions as well as negligent actions to be addressed. And I have no way of evaluating that. And so that would be my suggestion for you to consider. Senator Hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. McClellan, just going back again to this missing final framing report. And I don't know how the inspection business or the process works exactly, but it would seem to me if you describe typically there's a minimum of 7 inspections and they happen at 2 times when you do the foundation and the framing and whatever those 7 things are. And so when you do a project and you're inspecting a project, whoever's overseeing that inspection would say, all right, show me the 7 reports, show me the key inspections made. If those were not done, then it would seem to me raise some question in the mind of whoever's overseeing the inspection regimen to say, well, where is it? Did you just not get done? Or where's the report? Or when are you going to make the report? And did that happen in this case with this? I mean, if it was noted at the time that there was not this final framing inspection done, why would that not have raised a red flag with this department and said, well, if you didn't do it, go do it? Or if you did it but didn't do the report, make the report. What happened and where was the oversight or was there none?
Typically what happens, the inspectors know this is just integral to their knowledge of the job. They complete inspection reports every time they're on the job site. They'll have many, many progress inspections. In some buildings, there may be 100 of them because they're there so frequently for so long. Those inspections then are their responsibility to track and make sure that they approve things at a certain stage. They don't get to a supervisor when they're comfortable, when they've checked off the different benchmarks and they would permit the certificate of occupancy to be issued. So there was no direct oversight making sure that that occurred.
Mr. Chairman, there is just a comment on your suggestion for us to think on, and I guess as I've been reading through this and listening to this, it would seem to me that if there is a claim, and we haven't determined that yet, that it would center around the adequacy of the inspection and whether or not it was done as it should have been done, and to whatever degree that may have led to an earlier discovery of these faults. And I think that there may be some claim that could be made to say that the state's inspection function didn't perform as maybe we would expect it to. The larger question of the costs involved with the redoing the work and the recovery of monies that were paid to the contractor for the early completion, I'm troubled by the theory that the state inspection regime should be in a position to warrant that kind of performance. And it would seem to me that there is a fundamental responsibility on the part of anyone who's doing any kind of construction that person has to make sure that it is done correctly. And that responsibility, I think, cannot be, if we do accept that claim in theory, then I think that going forward, state inspections, even local inspections, are going to be done in a very, very different way. They'll have to be much more extensive and much more costly if that is the standard to which we hold. And I know we're not a court, and we're probably not, shouldn't be even getting into that, but I'm trying to think, if we're talking about claims and talking about is there a legitimate claim here, I guess I would think that we should talk about this inspection regime, what is expected of it, and whether or not they did in fact do what was expected, and try to focus on that as the basis of the claim.
And I'm also torn by that as being coming out of local inspection activities. I know you just don't see everything.
You can't.
It's because you miss something. So how do we deal with that? On the other hand, if I'm not performing what's minimally expected, then I need to be held accountable for that. And I don't know how to judge that here. I think that there may be other forums that discussion should take place. And I'm thinking that would be the best thing for us to do. In this particular circumstance, we have all the evidence to be able to look at. And we didn't have a collapse, and we didn't lose some lives in this process. And so there are some real blessings that have occurred here. But I think we need to act responsibly and get whatever has occurred in the past so that we learn from that and don't let it occur in the future. Just because a person is short time in it and you know, it doesn't mean they shouldn't be doing their job. And I think we need to discover as to whether they did or did not do their job. We can't really do that here. I would. Is there any other information that people think that we should hear before the committee decides as to how to deal with this today? Representative Laufer.
There's just one kind of fact thing that I would like to know, because I think it bears on sort of as we start out responsibility. And that is at the beginning of your testimony, you indicated that the department has a unique responsibility related to licensed facilities, and that's specifically outlined in law that's different than other commercial facilities where apparently we have a buyer beware sort of attitude. And can you once again just sort of refresh what you meant by that, what the special responsibility is of your agency to state licensed facilities?
In the state of Minnesota, the building code is enforced in some 20 counties, countywide. Outside of those 20 counties or 21, it's only enforced or administered in certain cities that have previously adopted the code. Everywhere else, the building code is not enforced, is not administered, does not apply. Originally, when the program originated in the early 80s, the law required that all of these types of buildings, licensed facilities, be plan reviewed by department administration. There was no authority to inspect them. As the years went by, budget and legislation was introduced that would actually give the department the ability to inspect them to make sure it met the plans that were being reviewed. So today, regardless of whether these kinds of buildings get constructed in a code city or outside in a non-code area, they become the jurisdiction of the Department of Labor and Industry, and we inspect them. However, if another structure went up next door, a retail store in this non-code area, it would not have any inspection.
Senator Holton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It strikes me, having served on a school board like Senator Hahn, and been involved in some pretty big building projects, that the architect is the representative of the owner, and their bottom line responsibility is to design and build a building and oversee the construction so that when the keys are turned over, that building is built to the standards. So, I'm envisioning doing a roof inspection on a size of a roof that covers almost an acre of land. That's a big roof. And I wouldn't expect you to look at every truss. I mean, there's some good points here, that there's some really gross negligence, seems to me, in the construction, for sure. I guess that's just my thoughts on that, you talk about redundancy. I mean, there's a contractor should be building to a standard that's within the industry, and then an architect should be making sure that that's followed through on, and then this inspector, I guess, would be kind of the final view on that. But having said that, I think that your course of action that you laid out makes a lot of sense. Do you make that motion as a chair, or would you like one of us to make it?
Feel free.
I will make the motion that you laid out earlier.
Senator Olstein, make a motion that we will turn the information over to the Attorney General's office and request the Attorney General's office to advise us as to what should or should not be done. We have indications that there may be negligence on the part of a contractor, on the part of an inspector, and there may be some state interest with regard to the overall claim. And we'd like their advice. That about covered, Mr. Lindeke? Anything else I need to include in that motion?
Mr. Chair, that sounds like a good motion. The motion then is to lay it over until we get that information.
That's correct.
Okay. That'll be my motion.
Okay. Mr. Olstein, Smith, any other comments or questions? Any other information that needs to be brought before us before we take that vote? All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no?
No.
Prevailed? Yeah. Is there... The bill is laid over.
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Lindeke.
The next claims that we're scheduled to hear on the agenda are claims from the Department of Human Services. They all, I believe, relate to the facility at St. Peter. The first of those would be the claim of Wes Gibley. Mr. Chair, Wes Gibley is at the St. Peter Regional Treatment Facility. I trust that all these three people with the claims are still there. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. He alleges that some members of the ground crew at the facility were transporting his Panasonic TV and VCR to a freezer because of a bed bug problem at the facility. It was damaged. He would like to be confiscated for his TV. The response from the department simply refers to something, Minnesota Statute 3.736, Subdivision 3M, which says that the Tort Claims Act, and it's one of the exclusions. It indicates that the state's not liable for the loss, damage, or destruction of property of a patient or an inmate of a state institution. I believe Representative Osment and I had a discussion about this a couple days ago because we were surprised that the law would say such a thing, since for 15 to 20 years now, this subcommittee has routinely paid or recommended that the Department of Corrections pay for losses to property caused by state employees at those institutions. In any event, there is no discussion in the letter from the Department of Human Services that anything is incorrect in the claim of the claimant that this was damaged beyond repair when they took it from him and before they brought it back. He has a letter in the claim indicating from Rochelle Fisher, a client advocate at the Regional Treatment Center, indicating the same thing, that the staff broke it when it was being transported. My recommendation on this claim was that since there's no dispute concerning whether or not it was broken while the state was handling it, that we probably should pay for the damaged TV. On the other hand, I questioned its value. $570 is a lot for a TV like this. I have one out at my farm. I see now that we have this additional piece of information. It's a Panasonic. You've got one of these in your files. Built in about 1995. Doesn't play DVDs. It plays only VCRs. And also, it's very likely that it's going to need a conversion very soon, as I understand it. So this is a television that probably, I only paid $120 for mine, brand new. So his claim that it's worth $570 is something I would dispute, but it seems that there's no dispute that the state broke it.
Would you like to respond?
Yes, thank you. My name is Ngozi Chukwu Akubike, and when he brought the claim, he submitted his claim for the damaged TV, we were unable to pay because of the restriction placed on us by the statute. And in addition to that, in reviewing the rules of procedure for this committee, we discovered that this is something that the court normally hears. Most patients, they go through the conciliation court process when they have issues like this, and the court, they come into the facility to hear those cases. So we are here to say that it's something that should be heard by the court, and if it's the rule of the committee that such issues should not be heard, that it will be better for the court to hear the case.
Sir, yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and maybe Mr. Lindeke. I guess I'm a little bit curious about Statute 3.736, Subdivision 3M. One way I'm reading the summary of this, it says that states that the state and its employees are not liable for the loss, damage, or destruction. And is that to suggest that, that claims should not be borne by the state for such incidents? And as you said, I know we've dealt with other similar things in the past year or so that I've been on the committee. And I guess I'm concerned if we have a law that explicitly says that the state cannot or should not assume liability for these things, then we may need to adjust our practices or change that statute. But I've not looked at that, and maybe you can you shed any light on this and how it may relate to this kind of a incident?
Mr. Chair, Senator Hamm. Representative Osment called this, I mean, after reading the three responses from the Department of Human Services on all three of these claims, he was attentive enough to his duties to go and read the statute, and then he called me down to explain what's going on here. And so we talked about it, and I also was surprised that it was in there. We both agreed that something ought to be done, probably something in the claims bill, to change the law in some way so that at least for the Department of Corrections, where we've routinely paid these for so long, and also for the Department of Human Services in their institution, that this would no longer be a problem. But in any event, we have... And I also called no less an authority than Peter Watson. And Peter Watson was the counsel to the claims subcommittee before I became counsel. Actually, Carla really was briefly. Peter Watson was before that. And Peter said, well, it doesn't mean that. And then I said, well, Peter, down in M, it says loss, damage, or destruction of property of a patient or inmate of a state institution. And he said, well, it doesn't mean that those things, we can't pay those. It's just under the Tort Claims Act. And I said, well, it says right there at the top of the item about exclusion that the state and its employees should not, in equity and good conscience, pay compensation for personal injuries or property losses. The legislature declares that the state and its employees are not liable for the following losses. So it not only says we're not liable for those losses, but it says about equity and good conscience and all that. So Peter said, well, how about 3.738? That's the one that says that we pay, that the only remedy is to go to the legislature if you're a prisoner. And I said, well, Peter, that just covers personal injuries. So, well, it was intended to cover property losses as well.
It says personal injuries in here as well.
Right. So, but then in M it only talks about property losses. In sub-3. So the point that Peter suggested that we amend 3.738 to include property from people institutionalized. And then we would have this odd, we would be conflicting with 3.736. And so the only reason I have actually here, I'll pass these out, I've drafted an amendment, which I gave a copy of earlier to Representative Osment, that we could put in the claims bill if we chose to, that would amend 3.736. The only concern I have, of course, is what are we doing? Is there something beyond the Department of Human Services and the Department of Corrections? For example, veterans' homes and a number of other things that we would be covering here by the word patient or inmate of a state institution. We don't exactly know all of what we might be covering. And yet, on the other hand, why shouldn't we, assuming an employee of the state negligently or intentionally damages property of a patient or an inmate in a state institution, why shouldn't the state be responsible for that? So it's up to these, to all of you, but I've drafted an amendment that we can look at.
Mr. Chairman, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Linicky, for that. And I'm glad that this was brought to our attention. It seems to me from just taking a look at this that at the time the law was written, it seems as if the intent was that people should go to court to determine liability. And that if that's the case in these instances, then maybe we should be referring people to courts instead of trying to do that here. And I know we've struggled with that in the past a little bit, that we're not a court and that we're not designed to replace that process. So I guess my question is, if we follow this course that you're recommending, are we in effect saying that we are in effect the court for these claims, even though the statute is anticipating that these things be done in a legal setting, not in a, I don't know what we call this, an administrative setting or a committee setting. And I guess there's some questions about do we have the ability to determine liability and fault and have power to put people under oath, and we don't have other powers that courts have to sort of ensure rights and maybe if there's some, I don't know, I'm just troubled by this whole structure.
Mr. Chair and Senator Hahn, the language about the courts here says without intent to preclude the courts from finding additional cases where we shouldn't pay. The legislature says that we won't pay for these. The Tort Claims Act is a way in which the state opened itself up, even though it is sovereign and has sovereign immunity, it opened itself up to be sued in certain instances.
Right.
And then it has a list of exclusions where, even though we've normally opened ourselves up, we're not going to allow people to sue us in this list for this list of things. And the courts, so the courts are not available. We haven't opened ourselves up at all. So the courts would not be able to look at any of this. If we were to take this exclusion out, it's possible that a person could take it to court. And that would be a possible solution.
Mr. Chairman, So if we do that, then we're saying you have to go to court. If we leave it in, then we say, well, we can deal with it here because the courts can't. Is that kind of the argument that Mr. Watson was making?
Mr. Watson was suggesting that we indicate that in these instances, so it could be an amendment where we amend both things. We take it out of this list so that it is possible to pay for these things. And then we also amend 3.738 so that we say that the legislature is the place you go if you're an inmate of an institution to not only bring your injury claims, but to cover it. That would possibly be a complete solution to the problem. Then they would not go.
Mr. Chairman, well, I was intrigued by Ms. Akabuki's statement that they regularly have conciliation courts in the facility, which is a whole different approach. I mean, quite honestly, I think it'd be wonderful if there was something other than us to be an independent third party to review it with some guidance from perhaps the state on how they ought to judge that, but I would never have assumed that a court would actually make visits and that there was enough business to even justify an officer of the court to go. So could you give us some background about, is this a once a month, or they come once a year? And I know we have a representative from corrections as well. I don't know if that takes place in correctional facilities as well.
It depends on the number of cases they receive from the patient. And it can take different forms. They either come to the facility or they do it by ITV. We've been having most of them by ITV, where they will connect us to the court and the facility so that the patient can participate in the hearing. At times it will be by phone hearing. So there are different forms you can take, and depending on the number of claims our patients have. At times they sue each other as well, so that's the way it's been currently working.
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Underkin.
How does the conciliation court deal with 3.736 subdivision 3 clause M?
They hear the testimony from the patient and staff and make a determination whether to rule in favor of DHS or not.
But if they are prohibited from, if the state doesn't pay for property damage.
For the most part, they've been ruling against the patient, and there has been appeal to the district court, and we've not had any ruling from the district court on those matters.
As to whether 3.736 subdivision 3 clause M prohibits the conciliation court from paying?
Yes. Or whether we
from requiring
whether
you
we are
to
liable.
Pay?
Mm-hmm.
So far they have not been successful in any conciliation court hearings.
I have not. We've had some, but I have not had anyone ready.
So it's not effective as it works now for the patient.
Senator Olting.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, this is interesting because wasn't it last year that we worked with that TV, that, or was it the guy's suit or something, you know, that his suit was missing, and there seemed to be some legitimate claims, and you're saying that conciliation court held in the facility has never ruled in favor of the residents of the facility?
I've only had, I think, two or three cases in the conciliation court so far, and there's no ruling in favor of the patient, and we've only had one appeal to the district court. So we have subsequent conciliation court cases coming up, so we don't have an idea what the judge will do in those matters.
Mr. Chair? Oddly enough, I do recall at least one instance when conciliation court did seem to deal with a prisoner property claim. There was a television that was confiscated from one of the inmates. It was confiscated because it had the number 885, which apparently are being the eighth letter of the alphabet, and the eighth letter of the alphabet from the point of view of the prison represented Heil Hitler, which indicated that this person was a neo-Nazi. So they confiscated his television. He indicated that he was a great fan of Dale Jarrett, whose number was 88. And now it's Dale Earnhardt Jr.'s number is 88. So, and he's one of the most popular drivers in NASCAR.
He's into Hitler either.
Apparently, as far as we know, neither Dale Jarrett nor Dale Earnhardt Jr. is a neo-Nazi. But in any event, they confiscated his television. He alleged that it had nothing to do with his Hitler, the neo-Nazi. Although Mr. Hartnett later suggested to me that didn't explain the SS symbol tattooed onto his shoulder. But he was apparently a Dale Jarrett fan. So he made a claim to the claims subcommittee. We were going to deal with it. And instead, some judge had an ad hoc conciliation court hearing in the facility in which I believe it was a woman judge, whoever the judge was, she ruled in favor and indicated that they ought to pay for his TV. And so there was at least that one instance in a prison setting where a conciliation court was held kind of on the spot, and an order was to pay for the television.
And one of the cases we had in the conciliation court, that was an issue of about ounces of shampoo missing from the person's bottle. And so it's not just the fact that they are not ruling in favor of the patient, it's because of the nature of the claims that they are bringing.
So, Mr. Chair, the real question for today, I mean, this is an important question, and it's probably a significant question, how we deal with this, these exclusions. But what I'd like to hear is whether or not you agree that the state employees dropped this guy's TV when they took it to or from the freezer to get rid of the bed bugs.
Your comments? Do you think the claim is valid?
We are limited on what we can do.
I want your opinion as to what the if the claim is a valid claim or not, not whether you will decide as to whether we'll pay it or not. We're wanting to know is that there's no indication that you're refuting what the claim is the same. And so if there's some evidence that's on the other side, you need to let us know what that is.
If we were not limited by the law, we would have settled the claim with the patient.
Okay. Do you have a suggestion as to how much that settlement would have been?
No. But it obviously it's not 570. It's far less than that.
Okay. Are there comments on?
Well, and Mr. Chair, Erhan, maybe we need to seek the. As long as we're going to go to the Attorney General and ask his advice on some
well,
her advice on some other thing, maybe we should ask her advice sure. on. I'm a little concerned about.
Let me address that.
Okay.
That
kind of go ahead.
In that this, first of all, it does bring up a question that I'm sure has been answered somewhere in the past. We just lost that history.
I would think, yeah.
And so we need to go back and pick up that history and figure it out. Secondly, my co-chair is not here, and I don't want to deal with this kind of an issue without my co-chair being here.
Yep.
And the so what I thought would be best if we kind of set that issue aside, let's deal with the claims like we normally do. We know that if we wanted to go forward, we can always put in the little phrase that notwithstanding. That's the term I was notwithstanding. And so there is a way to deal with this. So I'd like to set this issue aside until Senator Lass is with us also and we get
okay.
a chance maybe to get some advice from the Attorney General's office or at least some history on what happened in years past on this, because we've been doing this for decades that I'm aware of, and so there's got to be some history behind it that we're missing. So on the Dibley claim, do we have any recommendations?
Mr. Chair?
Senator Olten.
I would be supportive of paying, but not that price. So, We've heard a price of maybe $175 brand new, and it's 10-year-old TV or 13-year-old TV. It's probably worth $25.
Mr. Chair, there's an interesting question as to whether you pay what it's worth or what it would cost him to replace the TV. That's because the TV is broken.
Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think in these instances in which we have people who are not out on their own with a significant ability to earn dollars, when their property, I mean, their ability to watch TV is destroyed, which I suspect is something that helps you retain your sanity, although I'm not a mental health practitioner, but I can only imagine what it's like to be in a state hospital with serious challenges. It does seem to me that we ought to when it appears to be clearly just an accident on the part of state employees, but that we ought to replace it. I don't think we should say he has to go on eBay and try and find something this ancient, but rather to get another basic 20-inch TV and perhaps even some delivery charge, because I suspect he doesn't have his ability to get out and throw it in the back seat somehow.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hamm, to that point, maybe the way we deal with this is that we direct the department to replace the TV, not give them a monetary award to the claimant, but say, let's direct the department to replace the television, and maybe they can get a good price if they're something that would be quite advantageous and just give them
Well, Mr. Chair, that would be more in keeping with how we've always dealt with the Department of Corrections, that rather than putting a property claim settlement in the claims bill, we simply direct the department to pay the claim. And in this case, we would want to put a limit on, presumably, on replacing the TV is fine, but $570 seems a lot. We might want to come up with some limit on what we indicate that they should pay to replace this television.
Suggestions?
Mr. Chair, because I could fill in mine. It still works fine. We hardly ever go out to the farm. She's got one too.
No, I have suggestions.
Do you want to come to the table and provide testimony?
Identify
yourself for the record.
I was wondering if the department had an amount for TV.
I've been dying to speak. Good morning. Yes, it's $170.
Identify yourself for the record, please.
I'm sorry. Nicole Lynn, Department of Corrections, property officer.
Okay.
$170 we charged to replace the offender's television. Standard, clear view, everyone has the same TV.
Chairman, just this particular claim said it was a TV, combination TV VCR. Now, that may not be what you're replacing, but in this case, you would have to replace that function in addition to TV with VCR, would you not?
We would just give them, I didn't have these guys.
No, they're not allowed to have
these. Mr. Chairman, and that may be so, but if this is personal property that this person is going to brought with him to the facility and then would presumably have taken with him. All I'm saying is that if that was damaged or destroyed, I should be restored to what I had, not to, I understand TV is part of it, but he's also saying he's got a VCR here. Is that not possible to find a way to provide for that as well, regardless of whether he can use it in the facility? I think it's sort of secondary.
Senator Hance, we would standardize the TV, so once their TV was broken, they would get a standard facility set that everyone else has.
But, Mr. Chair, obviously that's the Department of Corrections, and this fellow had a TV VCR at St. Peter, which apparently is permitted there.
Suggestions?
I don't have the Sunday circulars with me, but, you know, I would think, Mr. Chair, at $170, you could probably purchase a TV, built-in CD player or whatever, video player. And so I would make a motion that we approve payment for $170.
That's the motion?
Mr. Chair, just trying to follow on Mr. Lindeke's suggestion, which was to direct the department to do that. I think in a situation which someone's in a locked, secure facility, that actually may be a better solution than check if that person isn't able to secure it.
Mr. Chair, I'll amend my motion that, is it public health? Department of Human Services replaces the TV up to a value of $170.
Motion? Any questions? All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Prevail.
Mr. Chair, do I understand then, Nicole, that they actually can buy a $170 TV at your facility. So if you have trouble finding one, they apparently you can talk to the Department of Corrections.
Okay, before we go to the next claim, I'd like to go ahead and deal with the minutes because we have to be out of here before 12 o'clock. We're limited our time, and I'm hoping we'll be out of here in another 20 minutes. But there is a correction on the minutes, January 22nd. It did not have those present, so we have present Lass, Olsen, Han, Osmond, Loeffler, absent Enzelf, and we have Senator Lass called the meeting to order. We would include that on the minutes. Is there any question on the correction? Okay, the minutes are before us for January 22nd. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, no. Motion prevails. Minutes are approved. As corrected.
Mr. Chair, the remaining two claims from the Department of Human Services concerning the, one of them is at apparently Moose Lake facility, and the other one, I don't know where Mr. Thornblad is, St. Peter. These, I've both recommended that we deny on the Janet claim. I was concerned, actually, was concerned that although they recommended denial and talked about the fact that they had offered him the option to send it out before it was destroyed, his DVD, CD, AMF, whatever this thing is, it's a very complicated machine, he couldn't have it in the facility. They apparently gave him an opportunity to send it out, and I wanted some evidence of that, and was sent that evidence. Here it is. Here's an indication that they actually offered him the opportunity to send it out. Just tell us where, and he didn't get back to them within the proper amount of time, and then they did destroy it. They gave him time to send it out. So I thank you very much for sending this to us so quickly. I was concerned, and she sent within a day we got this evidence they had given him an opportunity. He didn't sign it, but they did indicate that he refused to sign it. They actually showed it to him.
So that would be the...
That's the Danette claim. And the Thornblad claim, I don't think they actually broke the radio. The staff certainly wasn't negligent in breaking that radio. Those were my recommendations.
Okay. Any questions on the... genetic claim? Okay, how about on the Thornblad claim? Motion to deny both claims?
So moved.
Representative Loeffler moves to deny both claims, the genetic claim and the Thornblad claim. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. Those claims are denied.
Mr. Chair, although the injury claims are listed as the First Department of Corrections claims, since Mr. Sandman Shellico is here, I think perhaps it would be best to go to his claim first under the property claim.
Mr. Sandman, I believe Mr. Sandman is here. Would you like to come to the table again, Mr. Sandman? I'd like to... up to the committee. Well, maybe Mr. Mendicke, you could refresh our memories on the claim so we get everyone on the same page.
Mr. Chair, as everyone probably recalls, I'm sure you all recall, because it's such an unusual claim, Mr. Sandman Shellico was entering a facility. They indicated that his medicine bag that he wore around his neck could not come into the facility unless it was sewn shut. It was open. It's a very valuable item, very important to Mr. Sandman Shellico. They took it and gave it to a person who was an Indian who was visiting the institution in some not official capacity. and who was to take it to the Mille Lacs band, as I recall, of Ojibwe, and have a medicine man sew it shut. Unfortunately, his car was stolen. The medicine bag was lost. And there's no way of getting the medicine bag back. And so the question is, the claim is for $1 million. I believe Mr. Sandman Shelifo indicated that he understood when he was last here that $1 million was out of the question. But on the other hand, the department says they would be willing only to pay $75. And I think everybody was in agreement that that was out of the question. So we were left in a quandary as to what to do about Mr. Sandman Shelifo's medicine bag.
And to update members and Mr. Sandman, welcome to the committee, Mr. Sandman. To update you as to what has happened since the Indian Affairs Council met last week. They were here at the Capitol, and I asked to appear before them. I brought this issue to them, asking for their advice as to what we should do. I presented it this way. I said that there was as the medicine bag that's been stolen is irreplaceable. There's nothing that we can do to replace it. No amount of money is going to replace it. It's just irreplaceable. There's just nothing we can do. Asked them if there was a way for us to determine if what I would offer would be appropriate. And what I suggested to them is that we would offer Mr. Sandman $1,000 for the medicine bag loss. And their suggestion was they did not make comments as to the dollar amount, other than they reiterated that the loss is extremely significant in the lives of some. It would be losing the medicine bag would be like losing your life, and it would so it's extremely important. And it was also suggested that when I would present the offer to Mr. Sandman, that I would present that with tobacco. I do not have that. I don't know if Mr. Sandman is going to be here today, and so I'm not prepared in that way at this time. But that was the advice that I received from the Indian Affairs Council. And so my suggestion to the committee would be what I brought before the Indian Affairs Council is a suggestion that we offer Mr. Sandman $1,000in compensation for his irreplaceable loss of the medicine bag, and to see as to what his response would be. And so that is what we have before the committee, if that would be appropriate. I don't want to make that offer without authorization from the committee. Mr. Lindy.
Mr. Chair, I was at the committee meeting, at the Indian Affairs Council meeting, when Representative Osment was presenting the issue of the medicine bag to them. And I just want you to know that they were very, very respectful of Mr. Osment for being there, and they expressed a great deal of appreciation that he would bring an issue like this to them. And they gave him advice, as he pointed out, on the value of not the dollar value, but the value of the bag and how important it was. And Ms. Representative Osment did a wonderful job of presenting the issue, and the Indian Affairs Council appreciated hearing the issue, and I believe gave very good advice that we needed to resolve this. We needed to resolve it in a way that Mr. Sandman would respect.
And I'd also point out that we made certain that, and I assured the Indian Affairs Council that the circumstances that led up to this particular loss would not occur again. That this will be dealt with at the time that it's happening with the individual, and that we would have the future cases, the religious article would be sealed or dealt with appropriately, so it would be able to be kept with the individual. So that's, I guess it was contraband that they were mainly concerned about, that that would need to be verified and then sealed, and then it would be given to the person, but they would not be sent out of the institution again. It would not be something that would be delayed. I was especially stressed because of the lack of information that was presented to you. It's literally months longer that has you've gone went through before you even found out what happened to you. So anyway, that is what I would like to offer Mr. Sandman, and I would make that motion that you offer him $1,000 compensation for the bag. Is there any question on that motion?
Mr. Chair?
Senator Olsen.
Before that, officially a motion, I'd be interested in hearing what his thoughts are, Mr. Sandman's thoughts are.
Before we vote on that motion, we'll... Mr. Sandman, do you have comments?
Mr. Chairman, if I could, even before we engage in that, I'm a little... I wasn't at the meeting that you were at where you were given advice on how to do this, and I'm just wondering if we want to delay any formal offer so we can do it in the form that was suggested to us to be done.
We would, Senator Hand, excellent question. We would not be able to present him with the compensation until after it's approved by the full legislature, and it would be at that point that I, when the compensation is delivered, that I would try to follow up with the to be there and to present it in an appropriate fashion. There, Mr. Sandman, do you have comments on what we are before?
I don't know what to say, man. I can't accept $1,000. That's like I said, you're putting a price on my life, you know, my livelihood. The way I was taught to pray and stuff, I haven't been able to do since November 2nd of 06, man, and it's kind of stressful.
Is there any way that we could present something to you on that would... the suggestion that we had from the Indian Affairs Council of presenting the compensation with tobacco, I think was their way of trying to tell me there's a way that I can maybe present it that would be acceptable, that would overcome some of those challenges. We're looking for advice because the dollar amount is, from $1 million to $75. I believe we can get our colleagues in the legislature to support the $1,000. If it's a point, well, I can't accept $1,000, but I can accept $1,500, or I could accept $5,000, or I could accept whatever else, then it's not really a question of the money or of acceptance. It's a question of the dollar amount. If it's a question of trying to get you compensation that is within, I think, our ability to try and provide, and do it in such a way that can help to heal part of the injury that has occurred, we can try to do that. We would try to do that. But that's $1,000, the dollar amount is not going to resolve the objection that you're having, or that you, the medicine bag is really kind of like losing something that we can't replace. There's nothing we can do.
Well, money is something that I do not need, man. You know what I mean? I can't accept any offer, like I said in my claim form. But no dollar amount will ever be able to replace that medicine bag.
Kent, is there anything that you're asking for other than $1 million? So there's really nothing we can do. We've gone as far as we can at this point.
I have no idea, man. I mean, like I said, it would be a bad idea to give me that dude's phone number or his address, you know. I'd ask my uncle to go down there and talk to him, and I still haven't heard back from my uncle yet.
Chair?
Sure.
If I remember right, the car was stolen, and the bag was tossed out of the car who knows where, so it's, I think, from what I remember of the testimony, it's gone for good, I suspect. And so,
my suggestion.
Could you like to come up to the
$1,000 every month?
Would you come, please? we need to have your name
I'm
on.
Sorry.
If you could give us your name, and then so your name, it'd be all on the record. That's what we need you to get.
My name is Darlene Sandman. I'm Minogizit Manidoba Nasi Sandman Salafo's mother. And my son, when he was incarcerated, he sent me several letters pertaining to the fact that his medicine bag had been taken from him and that he had put in several requests with the DOC to have his medicine bag claimed back and put back into his possession, and that point never happened. And so here we are at this point today, and you people are offering my son $1,000, and like my son is telling you, that with a medicine bag that is as sacred as a sacred Bible or any of the sacred things that Christianity represents is the same as a medicine bag. It's the same thing. It's parallel. That medicine bag represents your people's cross, and it's our cross because it's the cross that represents all the four directions and the four colors of man and the four races of man and all the knowledge of our Creator who blew breath of life into every single one of us. And you're just saying $1,000. And my son is saying that no money, amount of money is going to ever replace that medicine bag, which it never will. But what I'm suggesting is that to come to a resolution on this so that this never happens in the future, is that maybe you guys should consider giving him $1,000 for every month that that medicine bag was out of his custody, out of his possession from the DOC. Think about something like that, because then that will ensure in the future that no other person that works in the Department of Corrections will mishandle a medicine bag that is sacred to the Creator and that is sacred to the individual holder of that medicine bag, the keeper of that medicine bag. Because with this medicine bag being misplaced by whomever put their hands on it, there are also spiritual consequences. Everybody uses the word karma. Everybody uses the word the universal circle of life, the path of life that we walk as individual people. Even though we may not go out and individually say we're going to do this or do that, but karmically with how this medicine works with Native American people is that when there's something wrong that's not right, that medicine will correct what's wrong. And it will make this right, if you understand what I'm saying. And it's not in a negative tone or anything like that. It's in a thing that non-Native people do not understand about Native American religion and culture and our practices and our traditions. And see, I think my brother is a correctional agency officer, retired. My other brother was a police officer and who was working currently here at the federal courthouse as a security guard, Russell Banky. I don't know if any of you people know him, but you can also talk with him, you know, about the representation and how important it is as an individual person walking with a medicine bundle. For myself, I can use my own self as an example. There was a lady who was dealt with up in Minnesota about 4 years ago now. She's currently in the correction, Department of Corrections. She committed arson. She burnt up 7 of my eagle feathers, my grandfather pipe, my buffalo skull, my Dream of Davy when medicine bundles. This woman is incarcerated for only 5 years. There has not been no money offered, no money claimed to me, and her burning up my whole entire medicine bundle, which represents the verities of the Ojibwe Nation throughout Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Michigan, and Canada. So it's like, this is something that's very serious. It's very serious.
That's the reason why we did take it to the Indian Affairs
yes.
Council.
Thank you, Chairman.
Senator Ham.
No, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I guess maybe Mr. Linicky, but in the packet materials we've gotten, we've got something called DOC allowable property list. It says, is that a document that is internal to the Department of Corrections, or is this something that has been adopted? It's got some guidelines of how to deal with personal property. It does say, and this may not be appropriate, but it says religious items, maximum value $75 per item. It's got some other things in here that talk about offender property from the Department of Corrections. My question is, are these things that are just things that the Department of Corrections has adopted, or are they things that are under the instruction of statute? And I guess the question that I'm wrestling with here, and I appreciate the testimony that these, what you're talking about here, are things that are not valued in a way that you would value other things, and I understand that. But when you have a loss of something that is not valued in that way, there has to be some
standard that is applied, that we don't run ourselves into a question of, I mean, I don't know if equal protection concerns would apply here, but if this is an area that has not been dealt with, we may need to find a way to do it so that we don't do harm unintentionally here by setting a standard that just may not be appropriate. So I'm just asking the question, if these things have been dealt with in statute, if we're bound by that, or if these are things that we have discretion.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hance, these are not statutes or rules. These are, this is the policy of the Department of Corrections. And that is correct, right, Randy?
Chairman, that is correct.
So these are, we're not bound by them. There is, of course, the point you raised that if we were willing to pay Mr. Sandman several thousands of dollars for his medicine bag, and yet if the department caused the loss of somebody else's Bible or any other religious item and is then again only willing to pay $75, there is something of an equal protection problem. But this is a very unusual case, and it's clear that this is an extremely important religious item.
Representative Lawson.
Well, I think we need to recognize that the medicine bag is not in the same way replaceable as a Bible for most of the Christian people that I know. I mean, it may be a family Bible that belonged to a past person, but it's not like it includes an umbilical cord and things.
My son's umbilical cord.
Right, that's my point, is that it's not at all, I think, equivalent, because it cannot be replaced in the same way. This is a much more valuable loss.
Yes,
and I'm wondering, and I respect, Mr. Chairman Telefol, that you feel that if you were to accept a monetary amount, it's almost as if you're putting a monetary value on
that. That's why I said I wouldn't be able to accept anything.
But I'm wondering, since we representing the state want to acknowledge that some things did not go right and that it was not handled appropriately, if you would be comfortable, since you have incurred personal expense, my understanding is not even living in the area, to come back here several times to make phone calls related to this, if you would accept a settlement for us, not in payment for the loss, but in thanks for your coming to us, bringing this to our attention so that we could change the policies of the Department of Corrections so that it would never happen again. So it would not be a payment for the medicine bag. It would be in honor of the expenses that you've incurred educating us and the Department of Corrections in changing policy. If you could think of there's a way that you could accept this in a different light, so that your loss is recognized in terms of the expenses that you've incurred in pursuing this, so that this doesn't happen to anyone else.
If that's a possibility, I think what I'd like to do is for us to go forward with our motion. We'll present it to you and at some time, and you can decide as to whether you will accept it or not. I have a motion before us to provide $1,000 compensation to Mr. Sandman for the activities that have been surrounding the incident, and is there any questions? All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. We have to, before we have know if that is available or not, we have to go get approval from the full legislature, and the governor has to sign the bill. So it would be a little while before we'll be able to get that. Provide you notice that that's available.
Yes, do that. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you
for coming down.
Have a good day.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Have a safe trip. Just put his name on.
Mr. Chair, we have one injury claim from the Department of Corrections and a number of other property claims, all of which I have recommended denial, all of the rest of which I've recommended denial. Oh, I know you're not supposed to end with that. I was trying to avoid that. So perhaps we should deal with the injury claim quickly if we can, because the department, in a rare instance, has recommended payment of exactly the amount that the lawyer representing the claimant has recommended, and it shouldn't take a whole lot of discussion.
Okay.
We can see.
We can do that. This is
The Burton claim.
Burton claim. The amount is $11,900.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. Perhaps Mr. Hartnett could refresh our memory on what this claim is about.
Okay, my name is Randy Hartnett. I'm the medical claim officer for the Department of Corrections. And understand, it's Mr. Burton, not Mr. Burnett. I did send a corrected front page of my claim response. Apparently that didn't get communicated to the response. I believe I was dealing with another case of Burnett at the time I did that, and I'm my own typist, which is probably not the best allocation of work.
Chair, could I interrupt Mr. Hartnett for a moment? The lawyer representing this claimant has indicated that we should call him when we're hearing the claim. Shall I call this lawyer?
You got him on speed dial.
Mr. Chair, we have like 15 minutes left.
Right, that's why I indicated that maybe we could just go ahead and resolve the claim.
Okay.
Perhaps I won't call the lawyer.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Falsani, who is the counsel on this record, who I also know to be a fairly eminent workers' compensation attorney up in Duluth, reviewed the medical findings in this, and rather than getting a specific medical opinion as to what the permanent partial disability should be, Mr. Falsani did essentially what I would do, which is to look at the medical findings and rate those against the workers' compensation disability findings and make the suggestion of a permanency rating of 14%. And I reviewed that as well, both to the medicals that Mr. Falsani arranged for, as well, both to the medicals that Mr. Falsani arranged for, as well as those medicals that came from the Department of Corrections and the outside medical provider that dealt with Mr. Burnett's injuries. And it was consistent with what I would have recommended, and so that is why I went ahead and recommended this. Now, there was a bit of a question as to there was no record of Mr. Burton having injured himself. However, the part of the reason for that is of the passage of time in this particular case, and I know that bad cases have had a tendency to stretch out over a couple of years. And I think that's what happened in this case.
And Mr. Chair, at least in my notes on reading this yesterday, Mr. Burton apparently fell on July 30th of 2005 and reported back pain on going to see a doctor on the 12th of August. So it's between July 30th and the 12th of August of 2005. That's fairly prompt reporting of the fact that his back hurt.
Mm-hmm. The other thing, Mr. Chair, is that I have myself been in the area that this gentleman claimed to have slipped and fallen in, and it is, in fact, slippery after dishes have been done.
So. All right, we have a motion on the claim. I'll make the motion to approve the claim for $11,900 as recommended by the department. Any other questions, concerns? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no. Most prevails.
Mr. Chair, the next item would be the request for reimbursement. Let me pass copies of this out. There's a nice memo from Mr. Hartnett requesting a reimbursement. This is an annual event of $3,737 $2.15 for sentence to serve in condition community work service claims already paid and amounts under $500 already paid. We get this every year, and these are, I'm sure Mr. Hartnett would back up each of these claims and payments, but this is a fairly routine matter for the department, for the claim subcommittee.
So moved. Okay. Representative Anzelk moves for $3,737.15 reimbursement as a department request. Any comments? All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Must prevail.
And finally, Mr. Chair, we have the property claim. I would ask you only to take out the claim of Reginald Tollfree. And the only reason is because both my superior, the reviser of statutes, and next claims counsel, Michelle Timmons, and I wanted to know a little bit more about these glasses. This fellow lost his glasses. It's certainly not clear that the department had anything to do with the loss of the glasses. They may not have even known that glasses existed. But the question was then, if this man needs glasses, did he get some glasses? And so we emailed that question to Nicole Lind, who responded, yes, we offered him some glasses, but he preferred to buy his own. So my recommendation had been that nobody recalls this person having glasses. There's no evidence that the staff was negligent. And now the concern that we had, how about his vision? Does he have glasses? Has been taken care of. The state offered him glasses.
Okay.
The rest of the claims and this one, now, I would recommend denial of.
Okay, so they're all recommended to be denied.
That's right.
Okay. Do you have a motion?
I'll make that motion.
Okay. Senator Goldstein recommends that makes a motion that we deny the property claim, the 14 property claims. Any questions? All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails.
Mr. Chair, that would be 13 property claims, since one of the 14 is Mr. Sandman.
Oh.
He's in the list of property claims.
Okay.
So you're really recommending that we deny the 13 other ones.
Okay. Stand corrected.
I think everybody understood that motion.
Anybody question? We'll correct the minutes to show it's 13 rather than 14. Any questions on that? Okay. Anything else?
Mr. Chair, no. As Mr. Lindeke alluded to prior to the subcommittee entering into session, we do have some other injury claims that I will try to get to Mr. Lindeke and the staff as quickly as possible.
Okay. Thank you. Anything else, members? Okay, we are adjourned.
Thank you.